George!
I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George.
George!
My sobriety date is January the 19th of 1994, by the grace of God, the 12 steps. Great sponsorship and a wonderful fellowship. God has graced me with continuous sobriety. And I say that, and I know this is a traditions meeting, but it's really hard to talk about traditions without talking about history. So I don't even know if we're going to get to tradition one tonight. I said that. I have no idea where we're going to go. I brought some props because I think they're important. I brought an outline of some history because I think that's very important. And I want to start off with some history, and I'm going to give the definition of the word tradition, hopefully, and maybe get into some history in this area that I know of and some other areas that I've been involved with because of my sponsor. But I want to start off with going back, and if you want to go way back, we're going to go back to 1784. We're going to start with Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a member of the Continental Congress. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was also later called the father of American psychiatry, and he started the American temperance movement. He wrote a 36-page on about us. It's called an Equality into the Effects of the Errant Spirits of the Human Body and Mind. We call it alcoholism today. That's what he wrote about. He was described as the habitual drunkenness as a progressive and an odious disease. I love that word. And he talked about the only way to solve that was total abstinence, suddenly and entirely. And that was in Dr. Benjamin Rush's paper. In the late 1700s, it was a letter written somewhere around 17 or into the early maybe the 1800s, there was an American alcohol consumption, the number of distilleries grew, increased enormously. The growing numbers of prominent people, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams, called for a change in drinking practices. Momentum was picked up by religious leaders who changed the notion from temperance, of meaning moderation, to temperance, meaning abstinence. And it began the growth of the American temperance movement. That's where it started. Then in around 1840, a group of six men, and we call them, we joke about the six men who started the Washingtonian Society. It was really the George Washingtonian Society. We called the Washingtonian Society. We always mention the six men. We never mention their names. So I figured being we should, because they really are part of the founding of what our traditions are about. It was William Mitchell, John House, David Anderson, George Steers, James McCulley, Archibald Campbell, and they met at the Charles Tavern in Baltimore and formed the Total Abstinence Society. They're the guys that started it. And they had the answer, but they left out a small part. And we'll talk about what happened to the Washingtonians, just like what happened to the Oxford Group, because it's important, because they grew and then fell apart. And there's a reason they all fell apart. What ended up happening is they held weekly meetings, and they brought in another prospect, someone else who was going to sign a pledge to stop drinking, and it was originally to stop drinking, and that's where their success was. In that was around April of 1840, around November, the Washingtonians held their first public meeting. The movement was growing rapidly. Widespread and enthusiastic support came from thousands of existing temperance groups. They had a whole bunch of them. This was due to the great success the Washingtonians had in mobilizing public attention on the temperance and relying on their experience sharing. One alcoholic talking to another. That's where that comes from. And it talks about the debauchery. And then in 1841, they organized what was we would call today Al-Anon and Alateen. And we, you know, we give Lois the credit for it, but if you follow the history, it's really amazing that in 1841, the Washingtonians organized the Martha Washington Society meeting of women and children in New York. They provided moral and material support for the female inebriates and assisted the wives and children of the male inebriates. This was the first temperance movement in which women assumed leadership roles. The movement also spawned juvenile auxiliary groups, and freed blacks at the time started their own Washingtonian societies. So, you know, we're going to be talking about unity, and we can see even back then there was one. It was all separate. different little groups. In 1842, Abe Lincoln spoke in front of the Washingtonians, and I'm not going to quote his speeches at that time. In 1843, the Washington movement peaked. That's when it started peaking. It reached most major areas of the U.S. Estimates of membership vary all over the place, anywhere from 100,000 to 500,000, depending on what source you look at. The sole requirement for membership was to sign a total abstinent pledge. Members included teetotalers, temperate alcoholics, large segments of adolescents under 15, and drinkers of various types whose numbers far exceeded the drunkards. And remember, at the beginning, it was one drunk speaking to another drunk for the purpose of sobriety and telling their stories. That fell apart because anybody who signed the pledge could then become a member. And that will have something to do with our third tradition later on, that the only the requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. It also has something to do with why we talk only about alcohol in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and not other substances. It's all about our singleness of purpose. The reliable estimate that over the lifetime, the movement had hundreds of thousands of signed pledges, but they believed the number of recovered alcoholics was about 150,000. 1847, the Washingtonians lost its power. That's when it started to die. The society originally favored moral secession to achieve information to the alcoholic through abstinence. However, the membership evolved to consist primarily of non-alcoholic and temperance advocates. As a result, the statement shifted away from the reform of an alcoholic to pursue legal matters of prohibition of alcoholism, women's rights, all kinds of other things, and they started to fall apart. There were such issues as religion they got involved in, and all this stuff broke them apart. They really believed that, when you read a lot of the literature, they believed that the real reason that the society fell apart, and Bill Wilson talks about it in Tradition 5, and he talks about it again in Tradition 10, that the real Washingtonians fell apart because they lost their singleness of purpose. They stopped worrying about the sick and suffering alcoholic and got involved in everything else. I'll tell you, that is one of the reasons we have a sixth tradition. We don't affiliate, but we cooperate with everybody. And, you know, we'll get into each tradition as we go along. In 1849, there was a physician by the name of Margus Huss who coined the word alcoholism. It took another 100 years before we picked it up here in the United States. In 1852, this is one of my favorite little pieces of nonsensical trivia. You'll find I have a lot of that. In 1842, the word Skid Row it came from Seattle, Washington. Seattle, Washington, there was a sawmill that actually had skids that rolled the logs down on these wooden planks. And it was used to be called Skid Road. And what ended up happening is the alcoholic vagrants ended up living there. And what ended up happening is we went from Skid Road to Skid Row. And that was the first place that all the low-bottom alcoholics ended up living. And it started in Seattle. In 1901, Charlie Towns opened up Towns Hospital. It was the first pay-for recovery treatment, as we would call it today, hospital. It was really for the drying out places, they used to call them. It was for affluent, and it opened up in New York, and then later on they opened up a moderate one, an auxiliary to that, for people who can less afford it. I'm not going to go into how much the money was then as compared to now, but I have those statistics if anybody wants them later. In 1902, William James started his lecture series in Adelberg, University of Adelberg in England, and they were published as something called The Varieties of Religious Experience, which eventually became a book, which was given to the Oxford groups, who they used it. They gave it to Ebbie Thatcher, who carried the message to Bill. He used it, and Bill got very engrossed in that. Bill is a very important part to looking at history. He was very big into all this stuff. And because of learning from the mistakes of all these other societies is probably why we are here today. Other than the grace of God, that's the real reason we're here today. That's the only reason we exist, is because of God's grace. In 1906, there was a bunch of doctors. In 1906, Dr. Shoemaker, Reverends Worcester McComb and a physician named Isidore Colbert opened a clinic in the Emmanuel Church in Boston. That's the Emmanuel movement. That's the next movement that followed the Washingtonians right before the Oxford groups. And what ended up happening, there was a fellow that came along in there. They believed in lay therapy. One alcoholic actually working with another, but in the sense of getting them sober. And some of their therapists was a guy by the name of Courtney Baylor, Richard Peabody, and Peabody was a movement in itself. He was a therapist. Francis Chambers and Samuel Crocker. Those are the guys that did the Peabody movement. Then in 1908, Buckman went to England and attended a meeting of evangelists, and he had a religious experience. And after that, he met Sam Shoemaker in Peking. And then in 1921, Buckman, who went back to Cambridge, he's the one who started the Oxford groups. It was the Oxford movement. It was really at the beginning called the movement was the first century Christian fellowship, and that's eventually evolved into the Oxford groups. They had a set of principles they lived by. There were four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. They believed to be delivered from the scriptures of the Sermon on the Mount. That's where he believed that came from. And after that, they had the five C's: confidence, confession, convection, conversion, and continuance. And then they had the five procedures. Now, that was their structure. And was listen to God, give to God, check guidance, restitution and sharing, and witness, restitution and sharing through witness and confession. And that's where some of our steps come in. And the traditions are nothing more than a continuation of the steps for the group and the world at large. And we'll read about that later. We'll hear about that later. And then in 1930, actually, Silkworth came in on the picture. He lost all his money, and he went to work at Towns Hospital. He and Towns did not agree. Charlie Towns did not agree on alcoholism as an illness. Charlie Towns did not believe it was an illness, and Dr. Silkworth did, and he was very helpful in instituting that in us. Then in 31, The Common Sense of Drinking by Richard Peabody, which was the Peabody movement from the Emmanuel movement, the Oxford group movement, the Peabody movement, a lot of movements going around, but still no Alcoholics Anonymous. We're still not even formed or thought of at this point. And at 1931, Roland Hazard went to Europe, and he met with a psychiatrist by the name of Carl Jung. And Carl Jung cared for Roland for a year. And Roland walked out of the hospital 1 year. Yeah, I said, Jung, that guy. He walked out of the hospital and got drunk on his way back. They don't know immediately. And he went back into treatment, and he was told that he could not be cured through anything. He needed some kind of spiritual conversion. We call it a spiritual experience today, where everything would be shifted in him. And then in 32, he sobered up through the spiritual practice of the Oxford group. Nobody knows if he got them in England or he got them in the United States, but he got them. And at that time, he got them. In 33, Lois had turned to her brother-in-law, Dr. Strong. And it's important we know Dr. Strong's name because he becomes one of the trustees of our foundation later on. So again, the pieces of God's good grace is being put into place for us to be emerged in our childhood or adolescence before we get in, a flying blind state. And he was subjected to belladonna cure, which is a hallucinogenic to take you away from the tremors of alcohol. And the rest of it was pruning and puking, is the way they described is what he had to do. Drank prune juice and threw up and took belladonna. He walked out and that was in 33. Now, between 33 and 34, a lot of events happened. Dr. Bob was appointed the chief staff of the hospital at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, still drinking at the time. Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox was published, became very popular among his early AAs. It's still popular today. A lot of groups use that as a meeting. We'll get into that in Tradition 4. Sister Ignatia and a friend, Thomas Scudari, who was an emergency room person, became the medical director of Ignatia Hall at St. Thomas Hospital. And she convinced him that alcoholics were sick and accident prone, and asked Scudari to allow them to rest in the hospital prior to release. And that's one of the things we talk about, needing treatment for the physical first today. Ebby Thatcher at the time was approached in Manchester by his friends Sabergy, who was an attorney, and Shep C in New York. He was a stockbroker. They were both in the Oxford groups, but Ebby wasn't ready to stop drinking at that time, so he ignored their pleas. In July of that year, Bill went in his second treatment into Towns, and it was also paid by his brother-in-law again. And he met Silkworth for the first time. And Silkworth explained the obsession of the allergy of alcoholism, which is what Bill ran on. And Bill started drinking almost immediately after that discharge. That was two for Bill. And then August, Sebra, Shep, vacationed at Rollins' house. Now, if you go back, in 1911 is when Bill and Ebby first met. And somehow or other, God's timing is not our timing. We're now in 1934, and they still haven't gotten back together. They will be soon, though. And what was happened is that they decided to make Ebby Thatcher a project. Roland Hassett's father, in case somebody likes some more trivia, his father owned Allied Chemical. He was very prominent, and that's where Roland came from. That's why he had the money to go away for a year, because his dad was so wealthy. Bill's third admission was in September of that year, again by his brother-in-law. Dr. Silkworth pronounced Bill a hopeless drunk and informed Lois that he would have to be committed. And now, this is when we thought it was over for Bill. Armistice Day, Bill went to play golf, like a good alcoholic, and got into a bus accident, got off the bus, went into a bar with a guy, started off with a sandwich and some milk, and ended up getting drunk one more time. And he ended up, again, getting drunk, and he was found... they were investigating sanitariums for him again. November, Ebby was staying at the Calvary Mission. He had heard the message somehow or other because they released Ebby to Roland, and the judge at that particular hearing was Seber G's father was the attorney, Collins G. Go figure that one out. God's infinite work being painted on this picture already. In December, Bill, age 39, decided to go back to Towns Hospital. He had his last drink, 4 bottles of beer, purchased on the way. He got financial help from his mom that time. So we talk about moms being, enablers. Thank you. I guess they were even back then. Ebby visited Bill at Towns Hospital to give him the Oxford group principles. Ebby brought Bill a copy of William James Variety Religious Experience at that time. Bill went left Towns Hospital, began working with drunks. He and Lois attended Oxford group meetings. Ebby and Shep C. at Calvary House. Sam Shoemaker was director at Calvary Church's headquarters, and that's where he was going. After Oxford group meetings, they would go to Stewart's Cafeteria near Calvary Mission, and they'd sit and have coffee, and we down here go to Denny's and Friendly's and all kinds of other places, but that's what we do. Now it's Starbucks. It's kind of changed over a little bit. In 35, Bill had a talk with Silkworth, advised him to stop preaching the hot flash experience, the religious experience, and with his alcoholics, and start talking about the medical view. May of that year, Bill was in poor spirits, and he went into the Mayfield Hotel. He was lost a big sale. He was back in business. He lost a big sale. He walked into the Mayfield Hotel, and he ended up calling up Dr. Reverend Kuntz, and Dr. Kuntz, who sent him to Norm Shepherd, who referred him to Henrietta Seibeling, and that was the kind of events that went on. And what ended up happening is, through Henrietta Seibeling, he ended up getting to meet with Bill Wilson, but it didn't happen on the first time. It was Mother's Day. There's two stories of whether Dr. Bob was plotted under the table. If you're reading the story in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, it said he was up in bed sleeping. There's one of those contradictions that we have in AA that we'll never know the real answer. But he was drunk on Mother's Day, so he never got to get the time. And then in June 10th, which is what we consider our day anniversary, and some people will tell you it's June 17th, We need to get, that's another one of those controversies. After a multi-day binge, Bill went to visit Dr. Bob at his house for a 15-minute talk, and it ended up being from 5 o'clock at night till after 11 at night, and that's where AA started. They suggested they work with other alcoholics immediately on the next day. That was on the 11th of June or the 18th, depending on which history you look at. And what ended up happening, they went to a local minister, and they introduced him to a guy named Eddie R. Eddie R. is described in Dr. Bob in the Good Old Times. Eddie R. is an alcoholic who had a problem every minute of every day, and every day there was a new problem. He would have probably been alcoholic number three, but Eddie did not stay sober. They had to put him in an asylum out of Dr. Bob's house. And eventually, when Dr. Bob died, and Eddie showed up with 1 year of sobriety at his funeral. He later became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the 28th, they visited Bill Dodson, who was alcoholic number three. It was not just Dr. Bob and Bill. It was Eddie R., Dr. Bob and Bill. The three of them went to visit him. And then they came back continuously for about a week, and it was Dr. Bob and Bill after that. And that's when it ended up getting the message to alcoholic number three, who got up and never drank again. Then they went to alcoholic number four, which is Ernie G., who ended up marrying Dr. Bob's daughter, Sue, and they had a child, and there was a suicide, and a year later, he died. One of the, which was Banana, it was her name, B-O-N-N-A, Banana. She died, and 2 years later, to the day that his daughter died, Ernie died. Bill W. returned to carry the message to New York in Clinton Street. There was a lot of history. There's a hanging that's involved, and somebody committed suicide in his house. He was probably the first halfway house as we know it today. Is Bill's house was a halfway house. And then in the winter of 35, you have Hank Parkhurst, the unbeliever. You had John Henry Fitz, which they call our Southern friend, sobered up at Towns Hospital. Hank and Fritz provided me a bigger help, starting AA in New Jersey and in Washington, D.C. It's two more groups that broke away from New York and Akron, which was the beginning in 36. They broke away from the Oxford groups. And that's when we started breaking away from the Oxford group in 37. Bill and Lois attended a party at West Point. For the previous 2.5 years, they were Oxford group members. So there was a lot of Oxford group involved in AA. They did a lot of stuff, a lot of Sermon on the Mount, a lot of reading of the Bibles. Some groups, I don't know about today, but I know when I got here in 94, Group 1 or up in Cleveland, they still read out of the Bible. I don't know if they do today. And Ebbie got drunk after 2.5 years of sobriety in 1937. Bill's brother-in-law set up the meeting between Rockefeller. We're going to talk about this further on as we go into traditions. And then 38, Frank Ames went to Akron and he inspected what was going on. He suggested to Rockefeller at the time to give them money. And we'll get into the dinner and all that. That's all in the traditions. I just want to give an outline of this history. And then in May of that year, he began writing the Big Book. So we're talking about 1937, the Big Book is being written. Bill and Bob, by the way, you might be thinking up a good title. They were not sure of what they were going to call it. There's lots of different stories about what they were going to call it. 100 men, 100 men and one woman, a way out. But if you go a little further and check out history, and I'm going to talk about sources of all this stuff, because it's good to know our history. I remember what my sponsor said to me. I'm not interested in your story. You're just another drunk. But if you don't tell the story of AA and find out how it works, we're doomed to repeat that. And that's one of the reasons we talk about unity. Titles were such as Heaven, 100 Men, Comes the Dawn. They were suggested, and that was in June of 1937. In July, there's a Lois's recollection, and Lois remembers, in case you want to know where that comes from, it was the first term of the word Alcoholics Anonymous. And a letter to Richardson and Chipman and Scott of the Rockefeller Foundation. Bill was already using, he invited them to meetings at his house, but he's already using the term Alcoholics Anonymous. So whether it came from a lot of the different stories we hear from, somehow or other, was already incorporated. by us. Duncan wrote a letter in support of AA, which became, and it's in our book today, and that's the doctor's opinion, and that was the first letter that was written. And then in August of 1937, the foundation was established. In 39, the draft of the book came about, and they used to send it back and forth, and through 39, there was a whole lot of things that went on, and I don't want to get into too much of the insanity, because if you look at how this book was put together and what we did, we're the best con artists, even sober. That's one way of looking at the way we're going to start looking at Hank Parkhurst. There's a story I like to tell. There was, in the old days, they used to send out a newspaper article. It's now, we call it public information. If you're a drunk and you want to be fixed, show up at this place. And there's a story of a woman out in Philadelphia, and I'm going to talk about Philadelphia because the unbeliever, and for those people who know about the two agnostic, one was Hank P., who died drunk, and the other one was William Burnell, who ended up sober and carried the message. He's the one who had an experience in a, and they prayed for him to get drunk, the group. There's stories about him that are really funny. They started a Bill and Bob, they were hiding meetings. They were all over the place while they were writing the book. And he would come in there and say he doesn't want to hear about this God stuff. So they said send him to Bill, and Bill made up a car polish company that didn't exist to sell a product that they didn't make, and sent him around because he was the only one with a car in the group. And that way they could have meetings without him. That's what they did for a while. Typical alcoholics, they were hiding from him. So he eventually went out and got drunk. They got their wish. And he came back and had an experience. Now he stayed sober. Hank Parkhurst was the one who's decided to not incorporate legally and write up, go down to a store and just write up different forms for shares of a company that didn't exist. And he was selling them to the other people. There was 600 shares that were originally set out. 300 went to Bill and Bob, and a lot went to Ruth, and they kept writing that stuff out and sending it along. So here is the background that where we come from, and that's where we start. Now, how do we get to what the word tradition is? First of all, there weren't traditions. Bill was smart enough not to say that there were rules, there were regulations, there were traditions. What he did say, that he called them the 12 points of assurance to our future. And Bill started this back, way back. His first writings went into the grapevine, which was in 1946, was the 12 points of insurance to our future. We were 7 years old at this point. We were in a trial and error period. We were trying everything. We were making a lot of mistakes along the way. And what I like to say the 12 traditions are the 12 biggest mistakes we ever made, because we've committed every one of those. And that's why they're in there, to prevent us from doing it again. And then what is the word tradition? Now that we got from points of assurance to tradition. Word tradition is a whole bunch of meanings, and what it is passing down of the elements, usually custom events or stories of a culture, which have been handed down from generation to generation, especially by oral communication. One of the bad things we had in the early days, it was only oral communication, very little written stuff that was saved. What ended up happening, even when the very beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we moved from one office in New York down to New Jersey, a lot of the original writings and stuff were lost somewhere in time and space and moved. Another one is a mode of thought, behavior followed by a people continuously from generation to generation, a custom or usage, a body of written religious precepts, a time-honored practice such a set of principles and practices, and in law, it's a transfer from property from one to another. Tradition, any body of works, words, styles, convictions, beliefs, which precede and have been handed down from the past to the present. In practice, it means a specific section of works arranged according to a certain interpretation of the past, usually made in order to lend authority to the present critical arguments. I like that, but it's so wordy. In brief, what it really means, and those are all different kinds of meanings of the word tradition, it's a specific practice of thought pattern and long-standing. We have a lot of long-standing traditions. To me, it's practice, then it becomes a custom, and then from that custom, it becomes traditional. And I wanted to talk about that here in some of the ways different meetings are. There are so many meetings, and one of the things I brought along was when I got here in 1994 in South Palm Beach County, there was 123 meetings. As of today, right now, there are 249 meetings just in South, in this Palm Beach County. In Broward County, which is right down the road here, in 1961, and here's the original meeting list. I brought it along because I like this kind of stuff. Here's the original size of the meeting list, everybody. And there was 42 meetings a week. Today, there are over 700 in Broward County. And there's all different kinds of things that different groups use. And one of the things, and we talk about practices, in this area, we do not use the four absolutes. In Cleveland area, try and get this out. In the Cleveland area, this is an actual pamphlet from the Cleveland Intergroup. It's the four absolutes. They also give out quiet time, which is a way to prayer and meditate. They have 15 points for an alcoholic to consider whether or not to drink. That's the Cleveland group. In Akron, they have the four readers. I want to talk about these things because these are important. Because we don't do something here, it doesn't mean it's not done somewhere else. And then we always talk about approved literature and not approved literature. All these things come traditional to each group, which is our fourth tradition, and it also comes to each area. What we do here in Broward County, what we do here in Palm County, when I went to Broward County, when I moved from here, they didn't do the meetings right according to my mind, because they just didn't do them the same way. And then when I went down to New York, upstate New York, they definitely don't run the meetings the same way, hour and a half meetings, hour meetings, smoking meetings, non-smoking meetings. All this has to do with traditions. Now, each group has a right to set their own standards. And as I was saying, in Akron, they have the readers. They have a guide to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have the second reader. They have spiritual milestones. And they have the manual for Alcoholics Anonymous. A manual for Alcoholics Anonymous. I like that one. Those groups have that right. There's a whole bunch of other ones I have here, but I'm not going to get into. I wanted to talk about what came out many years later. And I can find it, because I have so much good stuff. Okay, conference and non-conference approved literature. We talked about this at the beginning of the meeting. There is no such thing as non-approved AA literature. There is non-conference approved literature. All literature is approved within AA, provided you don't give the name and the title of whatever you're reading. You can say, I read something somewhere, and it refers to this. There are certain meetings that use non-AA literature as part of their format. And that's perfectly okay. It says, the following is part of reprinted from Akron, Ohio Area Intergroup website. And Akron has the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous in 35, where Bill and Bob have the famous meeting at the gatehouse of the Cybeling Estate in Akron, Ohio, and Alcoholics Anonymous was born in 39. The book Alcoholics Anonymous was published as the basic text of recovery. From the beginning, many cities and even individual groups published pamphlets that became known as can openers. That's what these are called, can openers. I love it. For many years, these historic pamphlets were the only AA literature available because Alcoholics Anonymous General Service Board came into being in 1950, and in 51 conference, the conference advisory action was to make made it and stated that conference feels that in the future AA's textbooks and literature should have conference approval. So it happened in 1950. This does not diminish the value of literature written before the conference. In fact, at the same conference, it was stated prior to the vote of the subject, it was pointed out that the adoption of the suggested would be not prelude the continued insurance of various printed documents by non-foundation sources. No desire to review, edit, or censor non-foundation material is implied. The objective is to provide, in the future, the means for distinguishing the foundation literature from which form is issued locally by non-AA interests. The Alcohol Foundation is known as AA World Services today. One of the things they did, if you go into an intergroup office, is they have all official AA literature or conference-approved literature, and then they have other shelves that's clearly marked non-conference approved literature. There are groups that read the 24-hour-a-day book, which is not conference approved, but there are groups that have a right to do that. There are groups that have Sermon on the Mount meetings. There's so many different kinds of meetings. So I figured one of the things I wanted to do, and I'm looking at the clock because I know I could go on for hours on this, but I do want to read something, a transcript of a tape that Bill did before we end tonight. And then next week we're going to get into how the unity thing came about. Source of information. There's a lot of sources of information. Conference-approved literature. The Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 and 12, A Comes of Age. Dr. Bob's and the Good Old Timers. Pass It On, as Bill sees it. AA Service Manual and the 12 Concepts of World Service and all the little pamphlets that we have. The Traditions Illustrated. The Traditions, How It Developed. Language of the Heart. That's AA-approved literature. Then you have some grapevine literature and you have non-AA-approved literature. Non-conference approved is Bill W. by Robert Thornton, Bill W. Francis Harrington, My First 40 Years, an autobiography by Bill, Ebby the Man Who Sponsored Bill, New Wine, and Search for Bill, all by Mel B. Grateful to Have Been There by Neil Wing, Harry Thibault, and I never say his name right, Thibault, by Hazelton Press, Miss Marty Mann, Sally and David R. Brown, Children of a Healer, the story of Bill and Sue Smith, Bob Jr. and Sue Smith by Christine Brewer, Not God by Ernest Kurtz, which is a very good book, Sister Ignatia, Silkworth, the Doctor Who Loved Drunks, Woman Pioneers, Slaying the Dragon, and of course now today, because we have such a great line of communication, you have the World Wide Web, which is a lot of fun to get on. I also thought I wanted to, before I get to reading this thing that, this transcript from Bill himself from a tape he did in, I think it was, I'll get to it. I think it was, what year this was? I think this was 1951, if I remember. But I want to read the names of the people, because we talk about the Big Book and the stories in the Big Book, because that's our first thing in print. We don't even know who wrote them. We talk about alcoholic number three, where did they come from, what did they do, whose dates are moved in. We hear stories about that when we go to a lot of different meetings and when you talk about the history. So I put together a Pioneers of Alcoholics Anonymous from 1934 to 1939. And we'll start in 1934, which was December 11th, which was Bill Wilson. We know he stayed sober. And in 35, it was Dr. Bob, and he was a co-founder, and he wrote Dr. Bob's Nightmare. Of course, Bill wrote Bill's story. Then there was Eddie Riley. He sobered up in 1949. They tried him. He was going to be alcoholic number three, but didn't make it. You had Dr. McKay, Akron. He failed to gain long-term sobriety. You had Bill Dodson, who became alcoholic number three, and he's the seven-month slip in the in-and-out slipper, they call it, in the second edition. Yeah, Ernie G, he was the in and out, the second, he was alcoholic number three in the Big Book, and then Ernie G, who was the 7 month slip in the In and Outsider in the second edition. I don't think he's in the fourth edition. You had in August, now he didn't stay sober. You had Wes Wyman, who got sober in 1949 and stayed that way. You had Hank Parkhurst, the unbeliever, whose story was in the Big Book. He did not stay sober. You had Phil Smith in Akron, never wrote a story, but he stayed sober. You had John Henry Fitzmayo. He's our Southern friend in the Big Book. He stayed sober. Freddie B. didn't stay sober. Brooke B., Billy R., Ernest M., Herb D., Alec, Russ, Bill C., Victor, and Lil. They never stayed sober. In 36, you had Howard Grinzer out of Akron. He stayed. Walter Bray stayed. He's the backslider. Joe DePaula, he's out of Akron. He's our European drinking. Myron Williams, he wrote Hindsight, he's from New York, he stayed sober. Paul Stanley stayed sober, Truth Freed Me. J.D. Holmes stayed sober, Harold Spencer stayed sober, and Bob Ovid stayed sober. They were all out of Akron. In 37, you had Stanley from Akron, the Car Smasher. Don McLean, no story, stayed sober out of New York. Bill Riddell, a businessman's recovery, New York. These people all stayed sober. Lloyd Tate from Akron, Bill Van Horn, he's the ward of the probate court, he stayed sober. Harry Zales, a close shave, he wrote stories in the book, he stayed sober. Florence R., she didn't stay sober, but she was very helpful to us, and there's a whole lot of history on her. Female Victory returned to drinking and suicide in 1939. But she was probably one of the people that had a lot to do with women getting into recovery. April Ed Treat, he sold himself short out of Akron. He stayed sober. Bob Evans stayed sober. Wally Gilman fired again. Charlie Simone, riding the railroads. He stayed sober. Jim Scott out of Akron, traveler, editor, scholar. He stayed sober. Paul Kellogg did not stay sober. He failed to gain long-term sobriety. We're in 1937. Bill Jones from Cleveland, Jack Williams from New York, Tom Lucas, Akron, my wife and I, he wrote a story, he stayed sober. People who didn't stay sober that year, the rest of that year, was Ned Polster and Jane S. And Jane S. wrote a story, sober for a few months, and she failed to gain long-term sobriety, and her story never got published, I understand. And then in January, Jimmy Browell, who we talked about earlier, part of the early history, he slipped on December 38, and he wrote the story, The Vicious Cycle. In 38, Clarence Snyder, we all know who Clarence Snyder is, he claims to be the third founder of AA, it depends on what you listen to, but if you look at the history, we're talking about 1938, can't be. He got sober in 1938. He wrote the story, The Brewmaster, Home Brewmaster. Charlie Jones from Akron, he stayed sober. Ray Campbell, an artist concept, he stayed sober. Van Wagner and Jack Darrow, they didn't continue sobriety. Norman Hunt, he's the educated agnostic, he stayed sober in New York. Harold Sears, Smile With Me and At Me, his story's in the big book. Captain Cokes, they don't know if he stayed sober. They have no record of him. He just kind of went off the world. Abby Garlick, he thought he could drink in the second edition. He stayed sober. And here's a guy's name who's very important in our history, a guy by the name of Bert Taylor. He owned a tailor shop. We'll be talking about him when we get into another tradition. They don't know if he stayed sober or not, him and his brother, Bob Taylor. He did lend money so we could get our books out of the hock, because they were in hock at one time. We'll talk about that later on. George Williams and Joseph Taylor didn't stay sober. Harry Brick, A Different Slant, he wrote, and he stayed sober. Ralph Floralong, A Prodigal Story, he stayed sober. Bud Ebsen, he did not, we don't know if he stayed sober. Archie Tollbridge, The Fearful One, from Akron, he stayed sober. Horace Mann, On His Way. John Dolan, Akron, stayed sober. Vern Phillips, Akron, stayed sober. Horace Crystal wrote the Grapevine articles in 1944, and he stayed sober. Bill H. stayed sober. And Delmar Tyler, it's Aces Full Sevens. He wrote a story in 1938. He stayed sober. In 39, we're not sure whether Pat Cooper or not stayed sober. So those are the people that we're not sure about. And once we are. And I know you want a cigarette, Chris. You'll wait a minute. Yeah, those are the guys that brought us our message, believe it or not, indirectly. And some of them are still in our literature today. I want to read, and this is mostly reading. After this week, it'll get a lot easier, I'm sure. But there's a lot of information, because the first tradition has all the answers. It's just the opposite of the steps. And the steps, you start with step one, you state the problem, and you go to the solution through the next 11. In tradition one, you state the solution, and you talk about it in the next 11, how you keep that solution. It's about what we give up in a lot of them. It's about giving up things within ourselves for the purpose of the group, and that's where the unity comes in. But I want to read an actual copy of a tape made in 1951 by Bill. And it's after the Jack Alexander article was published, which I have here, in case anybody wants to look at it. In 1941, it brought down a deluge to our little New York office of thousands upon thousands of inquiries from frantic alcoholics and their wives, their employers. At the moment, we passed out of our infancy and embarked upon the next phase, the phase of adolescence. Well, adolescence, by definition, was a troubled time for the young life, and we were no exceptions as groups began to take shape all over the land, and the groups immediately had trouble. we made the very sad discovery that just because you sobered up a drunk, you haven't made a saint out of him by a long shot. We found that we could be bitterly resentful, and we discovered that we had much better booze cure than we thought possible. A lot of us found that we could gripe like thunder and still stay sober. We found that we were in all sorts of petty struggles for leadership and prestige. A lot of us were very suspicious of the book Enterprise in the hands of that fellow Wilson, who had a truck backed up to Mr. Rockefeller, who was all about the dough. We began to have all sorts of troubles. Money had entered the picture. It had to. We had to hire halls that didn't come for nothing. The book cost something. We had dinners once in a while. Yes, money came into it. Then we found, little by little, that the groups had to have chores done. Who was going to be the group chairman? Who was had to pick up him or elect him or what? Who knew what those troubles were and became so fearsome that we went through another period of flying blind. That period of flying blind, you remember, had to do with whether the individual could be restored to one piece, whether the forces of destruction in him could be contained and subdued. Now that we are beginning to wonder in what the early part of our adolescence whether the destructive forces in our groups would rent us apart and destroy our society. Oh, these were fearsome days. Our little New York office began to be deluged with mail from groups growing up in distances and not in contact with our old centers, and they were having these troubles. There were people coming out of the insane asylums. Lord, that would these lunatics do to us? There were the prisoners. Where would we be sandbagged? There were the queer people. There were the people who believe it or not, whose morals were bad, and even respectable alcoholics at the time shook their heads and said, surely these immoral people are going to render us a suitor. Little Red Riding Hood and the bad wolves began to be abound. Oh yes, could our society last? And it kept growing, more groups, more members. Some groups divided because leaders were mad at each other, and sometimes they divided because they were just too big. But the process of fission by subdivision, this movement grew and grew and grew. 10 years later, it had spread into 30 countries. Out of the vast wealth of experience in our adolescence, we began to be evident that we were going to take very different attitudes towards many things than our fellow Americans. We were deeply convinced, for example, that we would survive of the whole as far more important than the survival of any individual or group of individuals. This was a thing far bigger than any of us. We began to suspect that once the mass of alcoholics were adhering even halfway to the 12 steps, that God could speak in their group conscience, and that out of that group conscience could come the wisdom greater than any inspired leadership. In the early days, we had membership rules. Where have they gone now? We're not afraid anymore. We open our arms wide. We say, we don't care who you are, what your difficulties are. We need to say, I'm an alcoholic and I'm interested. You declare yourself in. Our membership idea is put exactly in reverse. Years ago, we thought that society should go into research and education to do everything for drunks all the time. We know better now. We have one sole object in our society. To shoemaker, stick to thy last, and we will carry that message to other alcoholics and leave those other matters to more competent. We will do one thing supremely well rather than many things badly. And so our traditions grow, and our tradition is not American tradition. Take our public relations policy. Why, in America, everything runs on big names, advertising people. We are a country devoted to heroism, and it is beloved tradition that is yet a movement is the wisdom of our group soul. Know that we are not for us. So our public relations policy is anonymity at the public level. No advertising of people, principles, before personality. Anonymity, a deep spiritual significance, the greatest protection the movement has. As our society grows up and develops in way of life, it is way of relating ourselves together with the way of relating ourselves to the troublesome questions of poverty, money, and prestige, and authority, and the world at large. The AA tradition developed not because I dictated it, but because you people, your experience from it, and I merely set it on paper, tried bringing it up for years ago in 1946 to reflect back to you, since such were our years of adolescence. Before we leave, I must say that the powerful impetus was given the traditions by the gentleman who introduced me, a guy by the name of Earl T, and we'll talk about him in another tradition as well. One day he came down to Bedford Hills, a long time, in the long form of the traditions were written, and at some length because of the office, we were forever having to answer questions about group troubles, so the original traditions were longer and covered more possibilities of troubles. Earl took me in a rather quizzical and said, "Bill, don't you get it through your thick head that these drunks don't like to read? They will listen for a while, but not read anything. You will want to capsulize these traditions simply as they are 12 steps of recovery work." So he and I started to capsulizing process, which lasted a day or two, and then when I put the traditions into their present form. Well, by this time, I had a lot of experience on these principles, which began to think that might bind us together in unity for long as God might need us. And at Cleveland in 1950, thousands of us did declare, yes, these are the traditional principles upon which a willing standard, upon which we can safely commit ourselves to the future and so emerge from our adolescence. Again, the last year took destiny by the hand. And this was just transcribed from a tape in Chicago, Illinois, on February 1951. And next week I'm going to put together what the legacies were and get into tradition one, because we only are talking about one legacy right now, the one that we started, which is recovery. We will talk about the traditions, which is the unity, and we will talk about the symbol, and we will talk about how we got from the 12 steps to the 12 traditions, and we'll get into tradition one next week. Thanks for letting me share.